Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
All right, so we're back, and we are back in content mode. So what that means is we're putting aside, for at this point in time, the news cycle, the marketing, and those distractions that constantly consume too much of our lives. If you look at how much good American patriots are absorbed in the election process, I mean, do you really need to consume 24/7? The news has a motto: if it bleeds, it leads, because they know they can get your attention and get you tuned in and maintain this fixation with, oh, what's going on? How? Give me more details. And they're going to tell you why this is important. And it's really not. As a matter of fact, just look at life as you're on your way to your destination. There's a pack of rabid leftists chasing you or following you. Maybe they're not running and going to run you down, but they're following you. And if they catch up with you, you know that there's going to be harm, problems, or what have you. And so, I mean, everybody can kind of relate to the imagery of walking in a dark parking lot, heading towards your car. You hear the footsteps and you go, you know, now's not a good time to, you know, turn around and engage in a group of people all by yourself. So your focus is to get to your car, unlock it, lock it, get it started, and get moving and get the heck out of there. And so that's what we need to be focused on, is getting to a position to where we can actually safely start moving forward. This election is more important than you can even imagine, because we need to start communicating to our state legislators, to our county commissioners, and we need to start demanding that they actually provide us with protection that they are obligated by their oath of office. There's a reason why they take an oath of office, and that is they are obligated and duty-bound to support the Constitution and step in when our constitutional rights are being trampled upon or being removed from us. This is why we need to go through this content. And so what we're doing at this point in time, we've already gone through the body of the Constitution. Now what we're going to do is we're going to dive into the amendments, which means that there's quite a few amendments coming up. And we're going to kind of cover, well, obviously we'll start with the Bill of Rights, but we're going to cover why these amendments are important and why they're really not important in the grand scheme of things. I mean, some of these things, as we go through them, you'll realize, well, you know, that's an important amendment that provides a negative against government or, and what we'll probably find, just to be clear, we won't find a body of amendments that really grants the federal government a lot of general powers. They just don't exist. Now, there are a few general powers, if one would kind of construe them, like the 16th Amendment. But when we get into that, I'm going to prove to you that it does not negate other parts of the Constitution, so that it doesn't really grant, because this is the important part. The amendment identifies what part of the Constitution it's changing and how that change is to be done. The things you'll notice, and I'll give you the 17th Amendment as a good example. The 17th Amendment talks about the process of selecting senators. It does not talk about Article 5 and the Amendment Protection Clause that forces states to unwillingly give up their suffrage in the Senate. And so we're going to find that there have been amendments written where people did not understand the Constitution, and they actually wrote an amendment that became a violation or a conflict with the Constitution itself. And so with that, let me do some other things here. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And as you know, this is the only show that gets into the solutions. And the content is critical to those solutions because while we dive into this content, this is the academic evidence that is necessary to prove to you that the solutions are right here within the evidence that we provide you. We hope that you are starting to understand that you actually have an obligation as a U.S. citizen in your First Amendment rights of petition, in calling for common law grand juries, and more importantly, your responsibility as a part of one of the two militias. We've gone through this quite a bit. It's important to understand that you are obligated to step in and help serve in supporting the Constitution, because all citizens are supposed to support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, as you know, we are also looking for, let's just say, more listeners. This is not about money, because we don't receive, I mean, there are radio show hosts that actually make a little more money because they actually have better ratings, they get better coverage, and so forth. We want better coverage, but it's not about money and spots. As you can tell, we've picked up, I don't want to say a sponsor, but we are supporting a business, Ad Local, in the fact that they help us. So we're trying to make sure that you're aware of an opportunity in expanding your marketing. If you have a business, Ad Local is an awesome business that will help you. And more importantly, what you're doing in helping Ad Local, you're helping a constitutional conservative business actually, you know, grow and be able to provide better services and more services for your business. Thanks for tuning in. And again, we do need more listeners, because it's not about necessarily whether they're buying anything from us. At least they're hearing the message. I've learned this, that at one point in time, when danger really happens, or when an event really happens, and somebody understands what to do, or somebody understands how to recognize what is happening, then that person can actually state and take the position of what needs to be said, what needs to be done. 9 times out of 10, you know, the thing I don't like about most people is that they're whiffums. They're people that is, what's in it for me? And so, as you understand, we do create. Nobody just wants to throw money out to people just because we have an abundance of it, like Soros. But most people, and almost everybody I know, is a person that is a whiffum. There has to be something in it for them. I do believe that there are a lot of good Americans that, when they recognize this is their patriotic duty, they actually step up and they do their job. And they will, you know, do what's necessary. So the important thing about this listener drive is getting people to at least understand the message and understand that the people who have all of the authority to save and restore our liberties are our state legislators, not our governors, not the president, not Congress, not even the court system, our state legislators, because we are a Republican form of government. And it is they're the ones that have the constitutional oversight over our U.S. Constitution. So with that, we're going to dive right into the Bill of Rights. And so the best way to do that is to get into, excuse me, the preamble of the Bill of Rights. You have to understand, the preamble is kind of like an introduction, and it kind of tells you, okay, this is what we're going to be doing. And it was really important for Madison to ensure that he added this preamble. And because of this, it makes it and it places context to the Bill of Rights. And what the preamble of the Bill of Rights states is this: the conventions of a number of states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory restrictive clauses should be added. Now, I'm going to start over again. What he just said was that there was a number of, and actually what ended up, the reason there was a number and not all states, it wasn't until Massachusetts, and those who've listened to the ratification debates understand that Massachusetts kind of changed the ratification process, because what John Hancock, Samuel Adams, and those good men up in Puritanville felt it was necessary to provide their desired amendments as they ratified the Constitution. And so it kind of changed the paradigm of, hey, you know, let's ratify it and do what Massachusetts did and provide our own amendments to the Constitution. And so in the ratification debates, we've kind of read, I believe it was Maryland and a couple of others, that they ratified it and they also provided their own amendments. Well, as you can tell, we're at a hard break. So when we come back, I'm going to get back into interpolating this preamble, because it's really important to place the full context that Madison was doing here in this preamble to what the Bill of Rights really is. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so we're getting into the preamble. And again, I'm trying to create context to the intent behind the Bill of Rights. Why? Because most people believe, and they're under the false assumption, that the Bill of Rights were written for all government, that the U.S. Constitution, being the supreme law of the land, forced all states to comply to all of these things. In other words, the right to bear arms was protected because the U.S. Constitution said so, or your right to freedom of speech or religious expression. The Bill of Rights only pertained to the federal or the general government. So in other words, these restrictions only were relevant to the federal government. The states at the time of the Bill of Rights and after the ratification, until the Civil War, states could actually create laws that would hamper your ability to bear arms, your hamper your ability to religious practice. And as a matter of fact, every state in the Union banned Mohammedans. There was not one state that allowed Islam to be preached or apostolatized or even openly practiced. It was banned by all states. And people go, well, oh, they can't do that because that's against the Constitution. Again, the Constitution only constrained the federal government from doing these things. And as a matter of fact, the freedom of religion, the concept of the freedom of religion in the general government and the Establishment Clause, Madison was really clear. He just wanted to make sure that the federal government didn't start deciding, because once they have the power over religion, then they get to choose what religion, or let me clarify. Once they have the constitutional authority to start dictating religious, you know, laws or any finger within the religion of the pie of religion, they have the ability then to actually start dictating what religion everybody is going to learn, what religion everybody will at least follow. It will be the centralized religion. This is why, and I'm telling you this because the federal government has actually overstepped its bounds and has actually inserted itself and has created its own national church. It created the national, secular, godless church. And the federal government has been enforcing this concept that thou shalt not have any god before, you know, before the government of the United States or any government for that matter. And they've actually taken on the position of an anti-Christian government. Anyway, and it's kind of ironic how this has all happened. But let me get back into this. So the Convention of States and a number of the states during their convention in adopting and ratifying the Constitution expressly desired that they wanted to prevent the federal government from abusing its powers or a misconstruction that would allow for them to abuse their powers, that the states requested declaratory and restrictive clauses be added to the Constitution, and as extending the ground of public confidence will best ensure the benefits end of its institution. In other words, the establishment of this new government, having these extra restrictions placed upon it, gave better confidence to the people and to the state governments that the federal government was going to be, you know, placed into this box, that they can't meddle with religion. They can't tell you what you have to learn in school. They can't tell you you can't pray. They can make no... Well, that's actually the First Amendment. So why don't we just move forward? But it's really important for people to understand that the preamble clarifies that the Bill of Rights was literally only applicable to those, excuse me, to the federal government, and these things that were restrictive within the first federal government, or within the federal government, or within these first 10 amendments, I'm sorry. The things that are within this first 10 amendments, almost all of them are restrictive, except for the 9th and the 10th. And so the best thing to do is literally, let's just dive into what these amendments are. And the first one, and as a matter of fact, the Bill of Rights, as I have said, is clearly in context to the general government. And they don't get into some of these other things, such as healthcare. They don't get into energy. They don't get into education. None of those powers that the federal government has usurped is anywhere within the Constitution. they do talk about promoting, on occasion, science and education, but they do not have the responsibility, and they're supposed to do things. Remember, one of the big factors in the Constitution that constrains the federal government from becoming the almighty authority of all things, they are responsible for what we would say, they're responsible to ensure that the states, one state doesn't get favor from another state. I'll give you a good example. During the TARP bailout, when Bush was leaving office and Obama was coming into office, they violated the uniformity clause because they gave trillions of dollars to the state of New York, or I should say companies that are operating within the state of New York. These insurance bailouts and so forth, even though these states may be, or these companies may be in different spots or may have little satellite offices, theoretically and fundamentally, the TARP bailout was unconstitutional on many different levels, and one of those levels was the uniformity clause. The money that the federal government had poured out, they're constrained by the Constitution to ensure that they, you know, they lay these burdens. And as a matter of fact, if you get into Article 1, Section 8, then we, you know, this is where we'll actually find it. And as a matter of fact, right here, I'll give it to you. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes. This is Article 1, Section 8. And this is the preamble of this. And lay and collect taxes, imposts and excise to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. And so what that means is anything that they do, whether they create a burden. So if the federal government gives trillions of dollars to these companies in New York, they have not given that same advantage and or relief from these burdens of duties and imposts. There's nowhere in here in the Constitution that says that the federal government is to use the public purse to bail out anybody, whether that be a state, whether that be a person, whether that be a bank, whether that be a corporation. It does not matter. Anyway, let me get into this. Now, it's, the First Amendment starts off with Congress shall make no law. I want to be clear here. This means the federal government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in other words, they can't establish any standards of what's to be taught in school regarding religion. And when I say regarding religion, when you start talking about creation and or evolution, now you have two different theories of the origins of mankind. And so when the federal government comes along and says, we believe scientifically that we've evolved, well, there's actually, that's not a proven fact. And as a matter of fact, it is still in theory space, because until you can actually in an environment actually give proof that we evolved, which they've never been able to do. The Miller-Ulrich experiment actually proves that the conditions exist here on Earth, that life can be created here, but there's never been any evidence of how life actually formed here, because we are a planet of minerals, and the DNA strands, the software in creating life, just does not exist in nature. In other words, there is intelligence into those strands of DNA, which basically blows out this whole theory of evolution. We have learned through science that evolution is impossible, because it's like in the world today, we have the minerals capable of creating a computer. And based on the theory of evolution, there is a high likelihood that over time, a computer can be formed by the natural movement of the earth and everything else. However, that computer could not operate as a computer without the software for that computer to work. In other words, the hardware and every element necessary in building that hardware is abundant here on earth. but the software doesn't exist. And so when the federal government stepped into making a ruling that evolution was to be taught, they established a policy regarding religion, right? So what did the First Amendment say? The federal government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, does it say, well, in classrooms, we can do this? I don't see anything there where the federal government says, has this power and this ability to overstep its bounds and these constraints for educational purposes. It doesn't exist, my friends. So anyway, we're going to get back into the First Amendment. We're going to spend a little time on this because the First Amendment has a lot of power. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so let me give you a little more clarification. Because when they say Congress shall make no law respecting religion, now just keep in mind, this is a nugatory. This isn't an open door. In other words, they can't make any law respecting religion, but they can do some things regarding religion at all. Let me clarify what the federal government can do. As Madison said during the ratification debates on June 6, 1787, the powers of the federal government are enumerated. In other words, they're listed right there in the body of the Constitution. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So, in the enumerated powers, is religion any one of them? No. So, it is not within their jurisdiction. Just because they place this nugatory respecting religion doesn't mean that, oh, well, because you said we can't do these things, it doesn't mean we can't do these other things. And so if you remember during the ratification debates, I also read Mr. Iredell's comments regarding this. And this is what Mr. Iredell said from North Carolina. And this was on July 28, 1788. Did any man ever hear before that an end of the power of attorney, it was said, that the attorney should not exercise more power than was given him? Suppose, for an instance, a man had lands in counties of Anson and Caswell, and he should give another a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Would the other have any authority to sell the lands in Caswell? Or could he, without absurdity, say, 'Tis true, you have not expressly authorized to sell the lands in Caswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as the other.' A Bill of Rights, as I conceived, would not only be incongruous, but dangerous. Let no man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all the individual rights not relinquished by this Constitution." So you got to understand that the Constitution, the only reservation that the states really had, and it was a consistent reservation, there was no Bill of Rights. As they clearly pointed out, the Constitution identified what powers the federal government had. And as Mr. Nicholas said on June 10, 1787, in England, in all disputes between the king and people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, and etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? This is the most powerful part right here. Is the disputed right over religion enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. Okay? So that means that the federal government cannot even meddle in religion because it is not an enumerated power. But in addition to that context, you have to understand that there's this First Amendment that says they shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, which means that they not only have any enumerated powers, they have a double, this is what we call a double restriction, because it's not granted and it is also taken away by declaratory form here. The federal government cannot make any law, none. Regarding prayer, regarding, you know, any type of worship. That's why it was up to the states to determine whether they wanted to have a state church or not. The Establishment Clause did not affect the ability for state-sponsored churches to exist. Every state in the Union at the time of the ratification, and not one mention in the ratification debate said, hey, If we ratify this, we're going to lose our Anglican's support, the Anglican Church's support in our state, or the Puritan foothold that we have. We're going to lose, you know, our control over our religious. Let me come up with a better way of putting this. They, as at the state levels, relied heavily upon the church to provide education, health care, job services. The church took care of all compassionate services. The government only did the few things the government was allowed to do. And so at the time of the ratification, every state had a church that supported the people in those respects to compassionate services. And so there was not one whisper within any of these ratification debates where anybody even mentioned, hey, do you realize if we sign this, we're going to have to get rid of our state-sponsored church? It wasn't even on the table. That's why every single state moved forward after the ratification debate, and the federal government didn't even look with envy at these states and saying, hey, Puritans, you got to shut that church down. And as a matter of fact, and as a point of fact, Massachusetts had, and several states, actually banned the practice, the open practice of Judaism that the Jews could not openly practice in the state of Massachusetts and several states of the United States at the time. And if I remember correctly, Massachusetts became or opened up to the Jews to openly practice in the 1830s. I want to say 1833. Go look it up. You'll find that the Jews could not openly practice in the state of Massachusetts, and it was that way in many of the states. When they said that they were open and tolerant towards other religions, bottom line, that was only respecting Christian religions. Mohammedans were banned until the turn of the 20th century, Buddhists and so forth. All of these obscure, I mean, America opened up first to the Jews because there was a kindred spirit between the Jews and Christians. And so, and that even proves back into the, you know, the time of Christ and how, you know, there was this relationship, obviously, because Christ was a Jew. Anyway, I don't want to really get into the religious and preaching of that, but what I want to do is I want to prove to you that the states had all of the authority necessary to maintain their state-sponsored churches. And new states that came into the Union, such as Kentucky, Tennessee, they all established a state-sponsored church because that's what you did. That's how you took care of the people with compassionate services. Moving on, this is why the First Amendment is so, so, so important. Moving on. Congress of the federal government shall make no law respecting or abridging the freedom of speech or conscience. And I'm adding that or conscience because the conscientious objection actually was brought forward and they said, you know what? We have to allow people to be able to conscientiously object from being in the military and in killing people. And so the concept of a conscientious objector goes all the way back to the very beginning, because even in the very beginning, there were people that felt it was morally wrong, regardless of government or not, to kill another. And so that was respected as a part of that freedom of speech and that the freedom of conscience or of the press. Or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Now, what is peaceably assemble? That means that there's a place where you can actually go congregate and meet. That could be a park. That could be a church. That could be a business. That could be a private dwelling, a home, or a church. But it cannot be the streets and or the sidewalks. Every city in America has ordinances that you cannot obstruct traffic. Now, you can work with the city government. Let's say you're going to be, you know, doing some construction and you've got a building downtown and you have to block off for safety purposes because bricks may fall or, you know, bolts may come off of the skyscraper. So they have to put protective barriers up to protect the thoroughfare of people who have to transit that area to conduct commerce or to get to their jobs or what have you. Therefore, there is no law or guarantee that says you can go and shut down the thoroughfare of people, whether that be on foot or, you know, on wheeled traffic or what have you. You do not have the right to peaceably assemble in the streets. Folks, you show me anywhere where this says, hey, you have a right to protest the way we see these protests. I'm here to tell you, it don't exist in the Constitution. That is not a constitutionally protected right. And to petition government. So this is the final right. So instead of having a nugatory, this becomes a declaratory that the people have a right to petition the government for the redress of their grievances. That's your First Amendment right, and that is our First Amendment. And so I linger on the First Amendment so long because it has so many protections and so many powers that were reserved for the people. So With that, we will be right back and going into the Second Amendment. Please stay tuned.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so now we're at the Second Amendment. And the only reason we're taking this time in the Bill of Rights is because these are these have been used and exploited by progressives in trying to manipulate and change what these rights, what these powers and the reserved restrictions placed on government really mean. And so the Second Amendment, most people look at it as the right to bear arms. Well, actually, the Second Amendment is not the right to bear arms. And we look at the beginning of the Second Amendment, and what does it state? It states a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Pretty hardcore right there. But what does that all mean, and why do they talk about the militia? As you understand, there are two forms of the militia. I've told you this time and time again. There is the organized and the unorganized militias. To get into the details here, you have to understand Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, that Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. So when they're saying this, I'm going to change some of the words so that it puts it in context for you. The Congress shall have the power, the federal government shall have the power to provide for calling forth the people, organized militia and unorganized militia, if necessary, to execute the laws of the Union to suppress insurrections and repel invasions, because you, my friends, are the ones that are responsible for ensuring that the laws of the Union or the constitutional laws of this land are enforced. And you, my friends, are responsible for suppressing insurrections such as what we're seeing in Portland, in Seattle, in Louisville, in Minneapolis, and all these towns across America. When people get out into the streets unconstitutionally assembling, blocking traffic, they are outright violating the law. In the old days, that was called civil disobedience when you would just do it peaceably. But and that's when they used to do sit-ins in businesses and so forth. However, what they're now doing is they're out there in mob violence, damaging property, damaging persons, killing people, and so forth. This is a full-blown insurrection, an insurrection against the laws of our lands. Just to be clear, who's responsible of protecting and stopping this? Is it the police? Technically, no. The Constitution says you, the people. So the Second Amendment clarifies this by saying a well-regulated body of people being necessary to the security of a free state, well-regulated, both organized and unorganized, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So what the Second Amendment says is that you have a responsibility to own a gun and to defend the laws and enforce the laws of this land, as well as to suppress insurrections and stop invasions. That the burden is upon you, the people, not the ATF, not the BLM. No federal government has ever been granted, and there is no power within this Constitution granting the federal government the ability to enforce its own laws. If that's so, then when we go through these amendments, we're going to find, and I'm begging you right now to keep a very watchful ear and mind for anything that states that the federal government now has the ability to create its own enforcement agencies to enforce the laws, and that Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 is no longer relevant and to be removed from the Constitution due to this amendment. Yeah, that's right, because that's exactly what they would need to state to clarify that the federal government is now and has the cognizant responsibility and authority to enforce their own laws, because the framers understood that that is how tyranny is provided. Now, this next one has never really been too much of a problem. No soldier shall in peacetime, no person. Now, when they say soldier or army, I've said this before, those terms are synonymous with militia. Because what happens to the militia when it's federalized? It becomes the army. Now they become a federal army to be, you know, dispatched and deployed as necessary to suppress insurrections and or to, you know, execute the laws of the Union, as it states right there in Article 1, Section 8. So conditions for quarters of soldiers. No soldier shall in peacetime be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. But that has to be done. And if you understand the Civil War, they didn't have the ability to, you know, not every soldier had a tent and deuce gear so that they could go out and not have to, you know, be quartered up in a person's home. Back in the Civil War, they didn't have that type of stuff. They didn't have portable tents and so forth. And those types of things were logistically very hard to, you know, put onto the backpack of a soldier or infantryman. That's the word I was looking for, an infantryman. So that's why they created this law. Back in those days, they actually had to quarter soldiers in people's homes, or, you know, in their barns and or in their outbuildings or what have you. The Fourth Amendment, right of and search of seizure regulated. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. In other words, before they can come and search, they have to identify what place, where they're going to search, because they're not supposed to even have a general power of searching and seizing. So they have to have a magistrate, a judge that actually signs off on a warrant to allow somebody to come into your home, the militia at this point in time, the militia to come in. And you got to understand, this is a protection against the federal government. So it would be a federal judge involved, and they had to have probable cause, and they had to basically give that probable cause by oath or affirmation. So in other words, if they lied to obtain the evidence to come after you, to concoct some charges, then whoever went before the judge to say these things, the officer of the court, which is probably a prosecuting attorney, and or the police, and or whomever is all involved in making that statement, they all have perjured themselves and are subject to punishment. Anyway, the particularly describing the place. So they have to identify exactly what and where they're to be, you know, able to be searching you, and the persons or things to be seized. Now, what you do not see here is that you have to have, because they have to have a warrant, but you do not see an amendment to the fact that, oh, if it's in view or probable cause, that they don't need a warrant. It's pretty clear here that they actually have to have warrants to actually do any type of searching. And so I understand the importance of protecting a person's rights from search and seizure. I do believe, and in most cases in the past, it hasn't been that problematic. Not that it hasn't been at all, but it hasn't been as problematic as it can be when government becomes very tyrannical. Now, I'm here to tell you, because we've opened the door to allow, well, within sight, you know, within reasonable suspicion or probable cause, they now have used that where they've actually been able to search your car because they've seen something that gives them probable cause without a warrant. And so because we have done that to help empower the police and the police state, once they become tyrannical leftists that say, oh, well, we've had probable cause, there is no stopping it. So we have to undo some of these things that for noble intent, we allowed the change to be done, but not constitutionally. We have to go back and say, hey, sorry, we don't care what you see, what type of probable cause, you actually have to, by oath, swear that you've seen something very specific. You have to describe what it is, where it is, and what it is to be seized. So anyway, I've belabored the point. Moving forward, the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment of indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service. So in other words, when you're in the military, when you are federalized in the Navy, federalized as a militia, or you're serving in the Marine Corps or the Navy, then you can actually be compelled to actually have to answer questions. You don't have a right to not incriminate yourself. This is the right of incrimination. We'll get back into the Fifth Amendment in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.